Hi, and welcome to the Future of Dermatology podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Farah Kamangar, board-certified dermatologist. We are here to talk about anything and everything dermatology-related. You'll hear from me and my guests, who are dermatologists, physicians, experts, scientists, residents, and medical students in the field of dermatology. We publish weekly, so if you like what you hear, hit that subscribe button and show us some love, and thank you for joining us. Welcome back to the Future of Dermatology podcast. And again, very excited to be joined by Dr. Tina Bhutani. And I'm going to go over the full-on bio again, because this episode is all about you and the journey to be where you are. Any advice? Maybe so we can go back as far as...
How far do you want to go back?
As far as you want to go. And of course, Dr. Bhutani does not need any introductions. We all know her very well. We've also been involved with SF Derm for so long. Yeah. We're the chair of SF Derm for some time there as well. Worked really hard with the group, so you need no introductions. But I'll just kind of go over what you're doing now. Of course, you're an associate professor at the University of California, San Francisco, and also the co-director of the Psoriasis Center at Skin Treatment Center. And you do lots of, well, I'll let you speak on it, but you do lots of also scientific trials, clinical trials, lots of mentoring. So, so many great
things. We're a lot of hats.
Well, thanks for joining and start wherever you want in that journey. We love to kind of hear.
Oh, goodness. I think I was one of those unique candidates where I went to medical school specifically wanting to be a dermatologist. So I've kind of always wanted to be a dermatologist. I mean, it's kind of the generic story, but I had a really great dermatologist. I struggled with acne and went on Accutane when I was in high school and just had this like amazing derm that really took great care of me. Another backstory is that my family actually owns a Mohs tech company. So my weird high school job was that I was a Mohs tech and I worked with a bunch of dermatologists, surgeons, and I went from office to office during the summers.
It was a great job.
But again, I got to work with dermatologists, and I just found that like everybody was really happy and just like loved what they were doing. It seemed like it was really rewarding, whether it be treating acne or whether it be kind of curing skin cancer. And so I specifically, again, went to medical school wanting to be a dermatologist, which is, you know, most people find dermatology later on.
That's actually a really, really cool story. You had actual hands-on exposure too. You literally were in the offices seeing what's happening on the back end.
You had
total like view of what you were getting into.
And it's funny because, you know, I thought I wanted to go into dermatology to become a dermatologic surgeon and do Mohs, right? And then here I am like doing psoriasis and clinical trials. So you just never know where your journey is going to take you.
My fourth year in medical school, I was applying to ENT. I was like, I'm going to be the head and neck surgeon. Yeah. And then I see this like fabulous Mohs surgeon come in. She has a dual professorship with ENT and dermatology. Yeah. And I was like, who is this person? What do they do?
Yeah.
I think when you meet a Mohs surgeon, you're like, I want to be a Mohs surgeon.
Yeah. Well, I think it's just what you're exposed to, right?
And then you find psoriasis and you go, that's what I want to do. That's the next step.
Because that was the part of dermatology that I was exposed to. So of course that's like, I want to do that, right? And then as I became exposed to more and more things along the way, it's just like expands your viewpoint.
There's so many cool points of dermatology that I think people don't realize.
Exactly.
Especially even like social media or YouTube. They think they know what dermatology is, but there's all this stuff that even like maybe a third or fourth year med student doesn't even get to see. Like, you really develop it. Open the treasure.
See
your research fellowship.
Exactly.
And there's so many cool things with it.
Yeah. And so, and again, I think the other thing is like, you know, you see someone at the end of the journey and you don't really know everything that's gone into that journey.
True.
And I always tell med students, you know, like, don't be disillusioned by that, because, you know, even though I went to medical school wanting to be a dermatologist, I applied to dermatology and didn't match because it was, you know, it's a really competitive field, as we know. And so I thought, you know, at that point it was like the worst thing that has ever happened to me, right? Because we're just used to like, we're at the top of our class. We got into medical school. We were like always, you know, getting straight A's, like AOA, you know, doing everything right. And then to like not achieve this, like the ultimate goal, you're like literally think your life is over, right?
Yeah.
But now I look back and I was like, it was probably the best thing that ever happened to me. I went to do my internship and I was like pretty stubborn. I had actually mentors tell me like, maybe you should stop and do a little research before you apply again. And I was like, no, the first time was a hoax. Like I was just like, I'm going to apply again. And I applied again during my internship and I didn't match again. And I think that's when I was like, okay, I need to fix something. Yeah. Like, it's not just like, they don't want me. It's like, I need to improve my application. And that's when I started applying for research fellowships and found Dr. John Koo here at UCSF, who took me on as his research fellow. And I specifically remember on, my match day, the second time when I didn't match, obviously I was like disheartened. I was like, totally. And Dr. Koo calls me and is like, well, do you want to do the research fellowship? And I was like, well, I'm not sure. Like, you know, like I have this option. Actually, my medicine program had offered to give me a categorical spot and said, like, you're a great resident. Like, you would make a great internal medicine doctor.
Fork in the road. Yeah.
And so I was like, well, you know, like I could just take this easier route and just become a doctor, which is like what I wanted to do anyway. Or I could take this leap and like not know what's going to happen and, you know, go through it. And Dr. Koo specifically told me, he's like, Tina, he's like, in life, there are hills and there are valleys. And he's like, and this is just a valley. And he's like, I promise you that you will get to where you want to be. And I was like, all right, here I go. I'm in. And so I moved to San Francisco and I did the research fellowship for 3 years. I was like the ultimate super fellow. You know, most people do it for 2 years. But I actually, after my second year, did end up matching here at UCSF, which, you know, never in my wildest dreams. Like, first of all, I had gotten to a point where I didn't even think I was going to be a dermatologist. And then I ended up matching at one of like the premier institutions in the country, which is just like a crazy thought. And then I had like this extra year. So I was like, sure, I'll do another year of fellowship, you know? And then I did my residency here. And the year I was graduating was the year that Dr. Koo decided that he wanted to kind of semi-retire. He's not ever fully retired, but semi-retire. And so basically I just, you know, found myself in this like perfect situation where I could kind of then take over some of the stuff that he was doing with clinical trials and phototherapy. And so, like I said, it was just like that not matching, which to many people would have been the end of the road, was literally like the best thing that has ever happened to me.
And it's so crazy because I think we all know the power of Dr. Bhutani and all the things you can do and how intelligent you are. And Dr. Koo is like your number one fan because he's always like, Tina is just one of the best fellows ever, which is also, I think, another thing he was so excited about almost retiring because he was almost like nervous about retiring. But then, okay, found someone who can fill in my shoes. I felt good about retiring. But I'll never fully retire.
Never.
So it's incredible to think of a person with that high of a potential having that kind of a setback in this process. The derm application process is so humbling.
Because
it's like you take the top of the top and kind of based on nothing, these decisions get made, right? Because you had all the scores, you had all like AOA, like all the things, right? And you're just an extremely nice person. Like if you walk into an interview, it's not like, so, and I think people will never really know what it is. But or maybe you have kind of done a little bit of introspection.
I mean, I think what we don't learn in medical school, and maybe I think now students are actually getting much more savvy, but what I didn't know was like kind of those like interview skills, like the soft skills about like how to actually market myself at an interview and how, like what things to say. Like, you know, I thought I would just get by because people would see that I was smart and I was nice and I was going to be fun to work with. And, you know, and I thought that was going to be enough to get a position, but that's not enough, right? You need to go out there and you need to really let people know what you're bringing to the table, and just put it all out there, you know? And like,
this is
I think in business, you know, people get specific training on like how to interview. Yeah. And I remember somebody, when I was going off to interview, somebody told me, they're like, oh, well, you know, whenever you get a question, you just like flip the question back around on the interviewer. Like that's how they get by in business. But in medicine, like we would never do that. Like
you wouldn't dare.
It's like, if somebody's like, well, tell me about yourself. We wouldn't be like, well, tell me about yourself. Like that's just not how it goes. No. But in some ways they're right in that, like, and I tell this to my students all the time, it's like, yes, you answer the questions that's asked of you, but you quickly want to flip it and start talking about something that you want to tell them. You know, you figure out a creative way to like bridge to the meat, because otherwise you can, some of these interviews, as you know, are like 7-8 minutes long.
Right.
That's you can spend 7 or 8 minutes talking about small talk, talking about the weather, talking about sport,
and leave no real
and never getting to the meat of what you want to tell them. And then there's nothing memorable about you after you leave the room, right? Yeah. So like you need to get to the meat as quickly as possible. And it's not cocky. It's not, you know, inflated. Like
that's what you think. You're sort of like, well, if I go too far.
Exactly.
But, and attending in medical school said it really well to me. He was like, because I had these exact same things. And He was like, Farah, you're so far away from like a loud New Yorker type.
Yeah.
You know, like, even if you think you're approaching it, you're not.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Yeah.
In your
totally.
Head, you're kind of like, hey, I'm here. Exactly. So you're not there yet.
You're not there
so
yet.
You have a lot of room to go.
Yes. Exactly. Exactly. So, yeah. So don't be afraid to just, you know, flip the question around and like, get to where you want, tell them what you want to tell them,
yeah.
no matter what question is asked of you, you
right.
know, you need to figure out a way to bridge to it. Yeah, exactly.
And I do find,
exactly.
and it's not always like gender related, but there is a little bit of a, I just hear this more from women. Maybe men are also
yeah.
thinking it, but
yeah.
they're just not saying,
saying it yeah.
as much. But there is this sort of like, just being polite, being respectful,
mm-hmm.
these kind of things that you're kind of raised with.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you have, and then you're studying for so long. So you've worked on that skill set of like study, take test.
Exactly.
Show up, be on time, do the things, remember everything.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you just have to be like, here I am. I'm amazing.
Yeah.
And partially maybe at that point too, even though you've achieved all these things, you've gotten into medical school, you've done a lot of amazing things at that point. You're still in your head like, well, what is special?
What
about
is
you
special about you? Yeah.
And it's like, you're like finishing medical school.
Exactly. I know. But you're just in this room with
yeah.
like, you know, 100 other people that are also finishing medical school, and
yeah.
you forget that you have these unique,
yeah,
you know, qualities
yeah.
that you're bringing to the table. So,
oh my gosh.
Yeah.
It's so interesting. And there's a lot more that happened after.
Oh my
so
gosh. Yeah.
but it's such an interesting point. Cause I think it's that fork in the road moment. I feel like for
yeah.
a lot of medical students.
Yeah.
After undergrad, you're kind of like worried about getting med school, but you kind of get into, you know, most people
yeah.
do get
yeah.
in.
Yeah.
Then you get into residency and you're doing your thing and you usually get a good job after.
Yeah.
Some really super awesome jobs. Everybody pretty much gets a job.
Right.
There's
right. Yeah.
But that piece between med school and residency, a lot goes down.
Yeah. A lot goes down. It's a turning point for
it's
sure. And
point.
I think you grow a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, like,
yeah,
yeah you like you grow up.
It forces you
yeah.
to.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. And then what happened? So then taking over.
Well, yeah, then I came over here and it was a big shift. Like I had this false impression that I like knew how to do it all, right? I had been doing this fellowship for 3 years. I had seen Dr. Koo doing it all for 3 years, but you don't really realize what you don't know until you're like thrown
right.
into this position. And I would say that being a leader is not easy when all of a sudden now you have to manage people and you have to, you know, do some things that make people uncomfortable, or you have to change things.
Yeah.
You have to fix things that have been, you know, done for a certain way for 20 years
yeah.
and you realize, well, that's not efficient.
Yeah.
You know? And so it takes a lot of courage and it takes a lot of strength and it really makes you feel uncomfortable. And that's another thing we don't learn in medicine is like how to be a leader
right.
and like how to have these conversations. And we don't have leadership training in these
right.
camps on like, you know, how
yeah.
to be a manager and stuff like that. So a lot of that stuff you learn along the way. And it was really hard. It's really hard to kind of step into a role immediately after your residency. So
yeah.
I consider myself very lucky. I think it was
yeah.
a very lucky
yeah.
opportunity, but it was also a hard step.
Because that was a psoriasis center. The
it had been running
unit,
for 25
so
years.
Unit.
Yeah.
It was a large operation.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And luckily I was not doing it alone. You know,
yeah.
I had Dr. Wilson Liao
yeah,
with
yeah.
me, and to this day, you know, the best colleague in the world, and we did it together,
yeah.
but still, you know, I was on the ground, you know, every day and, you know, dealing with the staff, dealing with the nurses, dealing with the patients
yeah.
and like, you know, it's yeah, it was a steep hill to climb,
yeah.
but all things that you can learn over time.
Yeah.
yeah. Yeah.
And you've been amazing in that role yeah. too. And you've had so many medical students and trainees
yeah.
and everybody,
yeah.
like every trainee of Dr. Lutani's is just always like the best of the best year of their
yeah.
life because you treat
yeah.
them so well. And partially might be from these lessons learned.
Because I was there.
Yeah.
I was
yeah.
them, right? I was them at one point in time.
Yeah.
And so I think, yeah, I think now I'm really good at when I interview people, when we interview fellows, when we interview students, you know, it's very easy for me now to tell, well, I've been burned a couple of times, but you know, it's easy to tell like who's genuine
yeah.
and like who's doing it for the right reasons and who's in it for the wrong reasons,
right.
you know? And so I really try to build up those students that I think are really in it for the right reasons, that want to take good care of patients, who are innovative, who are entrepreneurial, who really like can take these things to the next step. And just, you know, again, picking nice people, because again, like we don't want our special to be full of terrible people.
Yeah.
And so I really try to build up those people that I think have really great qualities.
And what's it like now, like kind of having that responsibility of them applying?
It's like the worst. It's kind of like, you know, you're a mother. Like I talk about I think I was a mother even before I was a mother, because like these fellows and students are like my kids. They really are. And you, again, I think also because of like post-traumatic stress of knowing what they're going through, of being, having gone through it myself. I think that's really hard. It weighs heavy on you, and you don't want to see them fail in the end, which they never do. Knock on wood. They've all done great. But it's really hard.
That's really hard. Dermatology. If you want to get into the top places, do a fellowship with Jackie.
Not true. My email's gonna like explode after this. Yeah.
No. So it's fantastic. And then how have you found just like being in a large academic setting, lots of moving pieces? Yeah. How is that? And of course, you were there as a fellow and during your residency.
Yeah.
So maybe it was maybe an easy transition because you knew everything and everyone. But then I'm presuming once you're out of residency, it kind of turns a little bit more into maybe a different kind of relationship.
Yeah. I think, you know, working in an academic center has pros and cons. I think the pros are, like I said, it's from a clinical standpoint, it's so rewarding, right? And we've talked about this on past podcasts, but you're taking care of people that basically have seen 5 other dermatologists, 7 other dermatologists, you know, and have come to you because nobody has been able to kind of help them. And you're in this like unique opportunity to now help them fix their disease. But you know, at the same time, it's heavy. It's a lot to hold, you know, like on, because you feel like you're like, I have to be the one to now fix them. I'm the end of the road for that patient. But when you can be the end of the road and when you do help those people, it's so rewarding. And those people are with you for life, you know, they're lifers. They're like sending their family, they're doing it all. So it can be super rewarding. I think the hard parts about working at academic center, I think, are just like the corporatization of medicine. And we could talk like, you know, it's a big bureaucracy and there's a lot of hills to jump over. There's, you hit ceilings at certain points. It's like, it doesn't matter how smart I am or how, you know, savvy I am or what ideas I have. Like there are certain ceilings that they're going to say, like, you can't do that and you can't go past that. So, I think for me, that's been the hardest part. It's hard to kind of keep growing.
That's a really, we've talked about that with other in the podcast members too. I think most of us are now in multi-specialty clinics or academic centers, this kind of corporate setting of medicine.
Yeah.
Whereas I think in the past, in like the 80s, it used to be completely the opposite. Everybody kind of went into private practice, but now it's like less than 5%
do that.
So everyone's kind of dealing with these barriers of just heavy administrative burden like runs the practice. And it's a really weird connection. Like for us too at PAMP, it's you have this entire admin group who actually the medical group pays, right? The salary comes from the work being done as seeing patients.
Yeah.
That's the business of, you know, that's how
that's the business of medicine.
That's the business of medicine. So that you're funding this whole thing, but then the whole thing is not necessarily there to make you
there to
your
serve
everyday
you
better.
Yeah.
And
totally
then you kind
agree.
Of feel that at some point. And then in some ways there's even some initiatives that not only hinder you like in your own like personal ego, but you're kind of like, well, that just hinders patient care. And actually in their terms, hinders profitability too. So that actually makes no sense.
It makes no sense at all.
Then you realize there's this kind of disorganization because there's so many pieces. And then when you go corporate, I've talked to other people in other corporations also, and I said, this is just corporate. When you go somewhere corporate and the bigger you get, these issues come up. But the fact that these kind of settings is the people that suffer are the physicians, the patients.
It's
really crazy.
I don't think that's unique to just academic medicine. I think it's just medicine in general. It's a huge problem. But that's been, I think, for me, the hardest part about like working at a larger academic center.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the hardest parts of most of it.
Totally.
Academic centers probably do have more rules too, though. I bet there's probably a lot more layers of,
exactly.
And anything else that you've been doing, like the clinical research side, or what else have you been kind of?
Yeah, I think, you know, clinical trials have, you know, I continued clinical trials from, you know, Dr. Koo had kind of started the clinical trials unit and I continued it and have made it grow, which has been really rewarding. And again, I think that's one of the reasons that people come to a larger academic center is to get access to treatments that they might not have access to outside. So I think it's really important to continue doing clinical trials. I also kind of have participated in my own clinical research and try to do, you know, dabble in my own little projects on the side. But we've talked about this before too. Some of the things that I'm really interested in is kind of, you know, what can we do beyond just prescriptions and treating our patients? You know, obviously that's what we do and we're going to continue to do that. Yeah. But what else should we be thinking about? Yeah. You know, things like lifestyle modification and improving overall wellness and the impact that that can have on skin disease. So I've tried to kind of, you know, look at studies that can help to elucidate that a little further.
Yeah, it'd be amazing work around that.
Yeah.
I think
there's
also this thing that happens where there's like this major disconnect between like academics and all the things that are happening and then the public. And then there's like this void in the middle. And then a lot of people are turning to social media, YouTube, that's where they're getting their information.
Yeah.
And it's everybody who's like, not the Dr. Bhutani's opinion. So,
but it's really hard because the studies I want to do are really hard to get funded for that reason, because the bigger institutions, the grant mechanisms and things like that, they're funding those, that one type of science, right? That's always been done.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when you come in as this like California dermatologist who wants to study sleep and psoriasis, you know, they're just, they're like, all right, you know, whatever. It's like, they're not funding the studies, but that's the studies that patients want to do.
That's what they want to do.
Those are the ones that they want to participate in. And so, that's really hard too, you know, is trying to convince, you know, really hardcore basic scientists and, you know, these grant committees that the science that I want to do is actually science and that it's important for patients.
Yeah. And it's so important to have like the translation science, scientists like you, where you can be like, well, look, there is a molecular basis and then we should study this. And then you're speaking their language. You're speaking the language of both sides.
Exactly.
That's the way things kind of happen. And then you do all of your education, all of the lectures you give,
busy is an understatement.
Parenthood,
mom of two, you know, wife, home manager, you know, all of the above, like, it's, you know, it's a lot, but I like to be busy, and people who work with me know this and probably hate it about me, but I don't do well if I'm just like kind of sitting idle. And I'm always kind of looking up like, what can we do next? You know, I have some like forecasting and I'm always thinking about the future. So that's just how I function. And I love it that way.
That's true. You can do everything.
That's true, but
it's so interesting just hearing your journeys. Everyone's journey is so unique. And of course the role that you're in is just so massive, and there's so many things you do, and there's so many people you touch with patients, staff, the medical students you work with, and everyone you educate too on psoriasis, atopic derm, the things you're doing. So
it's really fun. It's super rewarding. I wouldn't have it any other way.
It's fantastic. And then also have to ask our future of dermatology question. So it's the Future of Dermatology podcast. We always ask what you think will be in the future, or what things you kind of forecast.
Yeah. Like I said, you know, I would love to see more patient-centered research projects, you know, kind of like going back to our patients and asking them what's important to them and basing our research studies around that. And then also finding ways to make clinical trials, clinical research more accessible to more patients. You know, we have so much technology now, you know, and we're talking about decentralized trials and, you know, we're starting to dabble in it, but I don't think anybody's really figured it out super well just yet. But I think we're doing a disservice to a lot of patients and a lot of people who don't live close to an academic center or don't have access to, you know, experts in the field. So I definitely think that those are places that we're going to make huge impacts in the future.
Yeah, that's true. And the demographics of the trials have always kind of suffered, right?
It's terrible.
Is a huge
barrier. Yeah. And I think a big part of that is not only that we don't have access to those populations, but the way we design our studies currently is not catering to a more diverse population. And so we need to really ease off on some of like, you know, the exclusion criteria in our trials and really be thoughtful about like why we're including certain things, not because they've been included in trials for like 10 years past and that's why it has to be that way. I think we need to be thoughtful. It's like, why is this person being excluded from this study? And do they really need to be excluded? Because if they were in the real world, I probably still would be treating them with this drug. So why can't they be part of the original clinical trial? So those are kind of the questions that we need to be asking ourselves.
And now we are going to be looking at.
She brought out the book.
I should hold it a little bit closer. Dr. Bhutani, would you like to tell us about your book?
Yeah,
and so sign it for me, Ashley.
This was a book that was, you know, came about a few years ago. One of our fellows, Nicholas Brownstone, you know, had this idea, and he said, you know, there hasn't been kind of an updated psoriasis textbook specifically on the biologics. And we said, you know, that's true. Like, the last textbook had been written many, many years ago, also by us, you know, with Dr. John Koo. And so we decided to kind of revamp this this textbook and a really contemporary look on the use of biologics. And we really took like a real world evaluation about, you know, like what is actually evidence-based recommendations and what can we, you know, what is kind of folklore and what has been kind of included, you know, in things throughout the years of our practice. And so we really hope that this is just like a really practical guide on how to use biologics. We try to filter it down to only the important facts and what you need to know. And hopefully to help more people prescribe biologics, because I think we know, like, it's kind of a sad statistic, but like, the number of dermatologists who have actually prescribed a biologic are actually quite low.
Is it still?
It's still pretty low.
With Dr. Koo, there was the graph of topicals versus...
Is it pretty low? And so I think, you know, most dermatologists still don't feel super comfortable prescribing these drugs. And so we hope that this will kind of filter it down.
Exactly. Still all the other pieces of maybe they don't want to do the pyrox.
Exactly. There's other reasons not to prescribe them.
Doing it. So I thought what could be cool, which is putting you on the spot.
Okay.
If you're okay with it, I might just go through each chapter, maybe just say one or two.
Okay.
Just super rapid response thoughts.
Things that we would think about. Okay. All right. Let's do it.
It's like one of those word association games.
I was like, didn't see this one coming.
You can even say unrelated to dermatology, but whatever comes to your
mind. The first word that comes to mind.
So this is actually my personal copy, and I really liked it because it is
Wow, you have like notes in there?
I have notes
in there. I love it. I love it.
Circle things. The caricatures are my five-year-old drawing in there. Those are things that happen in life. You can't help that. But I think it adds value to the
book. It does. Character.
So I'm going to just go through, and if there's chapters where there's not much to say, which I'm sure there is, just you could also say skip.
Okay.
I don't want to put you on the spot.
Okay.
But I will. So of course, there's an introduction, which I think we got a good introduction for you, why this was done. Interesting, she started with laboratory monitoring, but it makes sense, I guess. Yeah. That's your first step.
I think that's a question we get all the time. It's like, what labs do we actually order? What are we doing when we start a patient on a biologic? Yeah. And I think, you know, I am still pretty traditional, so I'm still checking a quantiferon and a hepatitis panel in most
for
of my patients. HIV in some cases, you know, if I think they're high risk. And so those are labs that I'm still doing. A lot of people don't always do those labs, especially with our new contemporary biologics and the safety profiles. We might not need to, but the reality is that a lot of times the insurance companies still want to see a negative quantiferon gold. So I still continue that
and
in
then
my
you'll
practice.
Do the annual quantiferon.
I just do an annual quantiferon. I only do hepatitis again if I think they're like high risk individuals. But I only do a quant at this point annually. I don't do it every year. Yeah.
Or do you check a baseline hep?
I do baseline. Yeah.
Baseline and then just every, you know, as there's risk factors.
Yes, exactly.
Do you look for like the CBC lipid panel? Not necessarily because the biologist, but just to kind of
So when I'm sending them to the lab, they're like getting their blood drawn anyway. So I do throw in a CBC, a chem panel, and a lipid panel, and I have them do it fasting. So again, and this is based on our knowledge of psoriasis and the comorbidities that we know are associated with the disease. So since they're going to the blood draw lab anyways, I throw it in there, you know, unless they've obviously just had it or had it done.
And unless they're very plugged into the system.
Exactly.
And you know what those things look like. I kind of do the same because I'm kind of like, if I'm really starting systemic therapies, I kind of want to get to know what is going on inside your body.
The other thing is that, you know, every time there's always a case where you like send a biologic and they're like, they have to try methotrexate, right? Like it doesn't happen as often anymore, but it still happens. And that way you already have your baseline methotrexate labs are done. So
yeah, it's actually crazy that that still happens.
I know.
So, you know, I mean, and we use methotrexate still too. It's not like a mess that we wouldn't use many instances. It works really, really well. It's not to like downplay methotrexate, but just the fact that if there's another safer medicine, we still have to go through this.
Yeah, totally.
It's crazy. The world that happens. So chapter 3, TNF-alpha class of biologic agents in psoriatic disease.
Yeah.
I mean, you could talk about this for multiple hours, but what are like top few things, top few tips or changes or updates?
Yeah, I think, you know, don't forget about the TNF-alpha inhibitors. I think that's the goal of this. We still use a lot of TNF-alpha inhibitors, you know, particularly in our patients with psoriatic arthritis. I think those agents still have the longest safety data and longest data on things like radiographic progression of disease and you know, things of that sort. So I think, if anything, just don't forget about the TNF-alpha inhibitors.
And then they're also like lurking around for HS too. So
yes, like they're there. Exactly. We're still using them.
And then the coverage is still pretty good too.
Yes, absolutely. Right? Access is still the best.
You can probably get them pretty easily.
Yeah.
IL-17 class of biologics.
Yeah. I think, you know, again, great options for our patients with psoriatic arthritis. I love IL-17s because they work really fast. Those are like the situations where I'm like, you know, if I need a patient who comes in and I need them to get clear quick, whether they have like really severe disease or they have something coming up in their life, or, you know, I think about IL-17s. I also really like IL-17s for tough to treat areas, scalp, palms and soles, things like that. Yeah.
That's where you go to.
Yeah.
This is actually unrelated, super unrelated tangent. If you're going topical, where would you usually go to for like palms and feet?
I'm still doing clobetasol. Old school clobetasol.
And chapter 5, IL-23s.
Yeah, so IL-23s are kind of, you know, our newest family of agents. I think their benefit is their long-term safety, long-term safety and maintenance of efficacy. So what we know is sometimes with the IL-17s, you know, they start to lose effect over time. That's something that we've seen. But with the IL-23s, they really, if they work, they really do keep working. So again, if urgency, if speed of onset is not what you're necessarily need at that point in time, I think the IL-23s are great.
That's kind of where you go to there.
Yeah.
Combination therapies.
Yeah. So again, you know, for me, I use a lot of combinations because again, I have a lot of really hard to treat patients.
You're getting the ones that we've all maybe tried a couple of things.
They've already tried the monotherapy, so now they need the combination therapy. And so, I mean, the world is your oyster when it comes to combination therapy. You can combine, obviously, with topicals, which everybody does, combine with phototherapy, you're combining with methotrexate, combining with oral agents, other oral agents, I should say. You know, at this point, we have a few patients where we're also combining biologics. You know, we need one biologic for their skin, but another biologic for their joints. So there's a lot of different combinations.
And they're doing okay, relatively.
They're doing great.
I think for most of us, we send to you.
Yeah, exactly.
We could just skip chapter 6 about combining biologics. Send to Dr. Bhutani.
Yeah.
Chapter 7, biologic agents for treatment of pediatric psoriasis. So that's a really good one too. Also one we probably maybe most of us might send out.
Right.
I don't know why for psoriasis, I kind of think that way versus atopic derm, I do start pediatric patients on injectables.
That's interesting. I don't see a lot of pediatric patients, so that's not something that I do a lot of, but you know, I think there probably is some hesitancy only because we get approvals later for pediatric indications. And I think there's just this perception that like, well, if the FDA didn't approve it, for a while, that it must be scary, but I don't think that's the case. And I think that hopefully that'll change with
time.
And
our pediatric dermatologists use these things all the time.
Yeah.
Special site psoriasis.
Yes, I think we talked a little bit about, you know, the special sites, areas like the scalp, intertriginous inverse psoriasis, palms and soles, genital disease, right? So these are places where, you know, you might not have 10% body surface area, but they make huge impacts on quality of life. And we also know that, you know, they might actually have increased risk for things like psoriatic arthritis and other comorbidities. You know, they're at higher risk for these things. So I think it's really important not to undertreat special sites because they are sometimes more impactful to patients. And so we should actually be doing the opposite, is we should be trying to treat them more aggressively.
That's a trend that's been really interesting that's developed over the years where you might have a small surface area, but if that happens to be maybe your general area and is like really decreasing your quality of life, you might even go to a biologic where if you can get it covered. But it's really because if the topicals you're using just aren't getting there, you go to your up your steps of what you think will work.
So the International Psoriasis Council, you know, released their new guidelines a couple years ago now, and that's what I use if I ever get, you know, a denial for a biologic for a patient, let's say with genital psoriasis, because they specifically say that a patient is a candidate for systemic therapy if they've either tried and failed topicals and or they have special site psoriasis. So even if it's a limited BSA. So that's kind of, it's like written in stone. There's like an easy to you know, reed figure that like anybody can
interpret. Right there.
That's an access pearl. So I use that a lot when I'm trying to get things covered.
That's a good point, actually, too, because we talked about forgetting access, the things to just have in your note.
Yes.
That's another thing. Just have your reference list,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly.
Just put them in there.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
I remember when you were, this is a while back, too, but we read the Psoriasis Center. This was like over 14, 15 years ago. And I remember you were trying to...
I mean, what are you talking about? I'm 25.
Yeah, we're five. I think you were trying to get clobetasol spray approved, and then we were on the phone with somebody, with insurance company, and she said, do you know who wrote the trial and who did the study? And you were like, I did. Please look at my last name. And I was like, mic drop!
I must have been really frustrated with that person if I pulled that out, because that's not something
nicely,
that I would do.
You said it nicely. You were sort of like, you know, it's the same last name as me. You know, of course, you were saying it very nicely. But I remember myself and Eric in the back and were like, that just happened. And that's literally the people who are writing the book.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
And a lot of the books have come out of Dr. Koo's group, your group. I mean, these are really the latest that we all look to.
Stay tuned. We have an atopic derm one coming soon.
Is there? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll do another one on that. Let's see. What other chapters should we look at? Comparing biologic agents? That's probably a hard one, right?
It's really hard.
You probably still get asked a lot. Yeah. Like, what's your first?
I know. And, you know, I kind of hate that question a little bit, because
so
I think they all work really, really well. Yeah. And there's so many variables, you know, including you have to really look at your patient individually. There's so many factors that go into like why you pick which biologic you do. And then a lot of times it's just coverage. It's just access. It's it doesn't matter which one I think is the best. It's like the one that's going to, you know, work
true.
Best.
It's going to
be covered
pad.
By the
Dr. Lopez.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a prescription pad. It's a suggestion pad. Yeah, exactly.
We could do this or we could do any of these other factors.
Yes, totally.
Long-term registry data for psoriasis biologics. I think most have those programs, right?
Yeah, so the FDA, you know, requires most companies at this point, or most drugs, to have not only kind of the pivotal trials, like the actual clinical trials, to show data, but then they also now require like long-term extension studies. The problem with those is that, you know, we've talked about this before, is the diversity in clinical trials, right? Like the populations that were selected initially in the clinical trials are the ones that continue into those open label extensions.
Gotcha.
So it's not really like a real world cut. And so that's why I really like these more real world registries. There's a few that have been done where we're basically just collecting data from patients in the real world.
Yeah,
these aren't clinical trial
happening.
Patients. These is like what's actually happening. So there's a few of them out there. And I think, you know, data is starting to come out. Now we have like 5-10 year data from these registries. And so far it's all been really reassuring, right?
That's a good thing too.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
Nothing
bad has come out.
Net, if you cast a broader net, it's still the safety profiles aren't changing. No red flags are coming up.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It's good to know. But you're right. It's all about how with science, it's all about the population you look at and how you the study design.
Yeah.
And psoriasis biologic agents in special populations.
Yeah, so I think we already talked about pediatrics, but I think another. A group of populations that we don't talk about, first of all, are first women of reproductive potential.
Yeah.
So people who are going to, you know, who might be getting pregnant, or maybe they're already pregnant. We don't have a lot of safety about these drugs in these populations. So I think those are really hard conversations to have, you know, to because we don't have hard data to show that, you know, you're going to be fine, your baby's going to be safe. And so even though we have, again, I think now enough real world data to know that these drugs are safe. But that's, you know, one population that we talk about. The other population is kind of elderly populations, patients with a lot of comorbidities, you know, other medical conditions. How should we be treating them? So those are kind of two special populations that we try to highlight in this
gotcha.
Book. Yeah. Yeah.
It's really important. There are populations where, especially I would say maybe even the pregnant race is always hard.
Yeah.
Everything.
I know.
But
I know.
The elderly population, there's so many pieces to figure out.
Yeah.
So I think that chapter of comparing the biologics is probably really important.
Yeah.
There too.
I know some people shy away from the biologics in the elderly population, but I like them because there's no drug-drug interactions.
That's
right?
True.
So
yeah,
it's actually a lot easier, especially with these patients with these long,
medication
lists.
List.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I wouldn't shy away from treating them.
Yeah. And it works. They're comfortable.
Yeah.
Last one, adherence to biologic therapy.
Yeah. So I think, you know, this is again, where it comes down to like the art of medicine a little bit. It's like having the conversation with the patients. You know, I think we always assume, for example, that patients are going to want a cream over an ointment because it's more elegant and it rubs in. But, you know, we've all had patients where they actually want the ointment. Yeah, they're like, I like it's moisturizing. You know, I want it to like stick on my skin. I like that feeling. And then I think the same is true with biologics. I think we assume that patients are going to want like lower injection frequency and, you know, they're going to want the newest drug. Yeah. But sometimes patients actually feel better when I can give them a drug that has 10, 15 years of safety data. I've had patients, you know, where I prescribe a drug with maybe a 2 or 3 month dosing interval and they're like, yeah, it works great. But then I forget to do it. Yeah. And they actually want drugs that are more frequent, which is like, again, counterintuitive, but like, you never know.
That's the medical decision making piece is there's so much there. You would want, but it doesn't necessarily.
Exactly. Or you assume that patients are going to want the nice, fancy auto injector pen. But I've had patients that like the syringe. Because they like the control. They can control the speed. Yes, they can like, you know, it's not just like it gets jabbed into their skin and they have no control of it.
It scares you almost. Yeah. I think I want the fast one.
Exactly. So I've been surprised. And so those are the things I think that we need to have these conversations to make sure that patients are going to continue the medications that we put them on.
Right.
Otherwise, you know, if we don't pick one that's going to, you know, suit their lifestyle or suit them, then they're just going to drop it.
Yeah. And not do it. Yeah. And then also convincing them about, I forget the term, what did we say earlier? It was like your maintenance while on therapy.
Remission on treatment.
Remission on treatment. I'm totally stealing that. Yeah. Remission on treatment is a stay on treatment.
Stay on treatment. Yeah. If you stop the treatment, your psoriasis will come back.
And this was, what, a year ago, 2 years ago?
This was 2 years
Any
ago.
Major updates since this came out? Chapter 11 and 12
too. Exactly. No, I think, you know, we were able to include data in that book about our newest biologic agent, which is bimekizumab. So there's data on there in the book. I think it was pretty comprehensive at the time.
Yeah, I love it. It really is really, really great. And then it's also probably better just to get you to tell us things really quickly.
Rather than read the book. Buy the book.
Where do we get Amazon?
Amazon has the book. You can buy it on Amazon. Yeah.
Anything new about the atopic derm one coming out? I guess, you don't want to sell us too much.
No, I think for that one, what we tried to do in order to make it a little bit more engaging to read and not so dry is we made it case-based. So each chapter still focuses on a different, you know, medication class, but it's centered around a case. And so I think hopefully that'll make it a little bit more engaging, a little educational. That should be out just in the next couple months.
That's fine. Okay, we'll have to do another. Another review on the atopic derm.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Put the book back in. Back in view. Thanks again.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Future of Dermatology podcast. Remember to hit that subscribe button and share the podcast with your friends. The more you share and subscribe, the more we'll be able to grow and share our dermatology knowledge. If you have burning dermatology questions, feel free to leave them in the comment below, and we would love to address them in a future episode. And please note that this podcast is not intended to substitute for medical advice from your doctor.